104.6.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 26th of February. We will continue listening to Tenton's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello once more, and I hope you've had a fruitful week. In our last program, we started looking at the third chapter of Shanti Davis' text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which, I said, completed the seven-limb practice with verses on rejoicing, requesting the Buddhas to teach, ask them not to pass into parinirvana, and dedication. In any action, three things are most important: the motivation, the action itself, and the dedication, which can mean how happy you are at having done the action. In the teachings on karma, a complete action is one that has all these three: motivation, action, and dedication, focused on an intended object. So, for instance, if you know of someone that is ill and you decide to visit and help them, the object is the sick person. The intention is to be of benefit, and the action is actually visiting and doing what you can for the unwell person. Then afterwards, on your way home, you may think about what you've done and feel very happy that you were able to help. That seals the action and makes it a complete karma. Of course, if you went home feeling frustrated with yourself for having wasted so much time with a sick person, the karmic result would be quite different from rejoicing in your action. So that is why we always try to be as happy as possible about our positive actions and dedicate them to enlightenment, while we feel remorse for our negative actions and try to determine not to commit them again. Feeling joyful about doing an action strengthens the karmic result, and regretting the action weakens the karma. So now, to make listening to this program a complete positive action, let's set our motivation as we usually do. As I've said before, the more positive our motivation, the stronger the positive karmic result. So the motivation to attain enlightenment, to be of the greatest benefit to all others, will make an action very powerful. Why? Because the object is all other living beings, and the intention is to bring them all benefit and not to harm them. The object is very vast, and therefore the motivation and the positive potential become very vast. Therefore, in thinking about our motivation for the program today, let's try to set that intention to attain enlightenment, to be of greatest benefit to all others, which we call the bodhicitta motivation. So to get most out of this time together, let's just take a moment to do that. Thank you. Now, the last verse we talked about before we ended last week's program was the seventh of chapter 3, and it went like this: Thus, by the virtue collected through all that I have done, may the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. As I said in that program, this is a general dedication for the happiness of all living beings. In accordance with the Bodhisattva practice of giving everything away, even one's body and merit, Shanti Deva gifts the positive potential he has created through the seven-limb practice to the relief of suffering of all beings everywhere. You can see that this cultivates a very expansive and open mind and frees him from self-absorption and the claustrophobic mind that is always looking to gain something for itself. As we mentioned last week, we have to let go of everything if we really want spiritual liberation, and what better way than to give it all to others. We imagine all our good resources, our body and our positive potential, and dedicate them to alleviating the many and varied sufferings of living creatures. In this way, we free ourselves of possessiveness and make ourselves ready to accept and deal with whatever comes along, whether much joy or equally much pain. And I left you with Chogyam Trungpa's teaching that we let go with a prayer that whatever happens, pleasure or pain, may it be for the best. With that, the ego will find nothing to grasp at, and we will experience something of the peace of nirvana. In the following verses, Shantideva moves from a general dedication to specific dedications, and when I first heard these, they really inspired me. Judging by the pleasure I got out of the verses, I would say these are my favorite out of the whole text. The sixth chapter on patience really has some very powerful arguments, but for just approaching the sublime through commitments, for me this chapter has it all. That's not to say I can do anything more than just to aspire to what Shantideva dedicates himself to here, but even just reading these verses encourages me. I wonder if they have the same effect on you. As we go through them, see what you think. The eighth verse starts it off with, "May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world, until everyone is healed." As we've mentioned before, the doctor, medicine, nurse analogy for the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is common in Buddhism. Seeing ourselves as sick due to our ignorance, we regard the Buddha as our doctor, his prescription, the Dharma, as our medicine, and the Sangha, our helpers, as the nurses. However, here, Shantideva prays to become all three for all beings, and not only in the physical sense, but in the spiritual sense as well, and in particular, for our afflictions of attachment, aversion, and ignorance. It's like a mother contemplating her one and only child who's sick. She will do anything to bring this child back to good health, even if she has to take the child's sickness onto herself. In commenting on the verse, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has mentioned Mother Teresa helping the destitute in India, and also said we should not shirk all the suffering people in Africa. But if we can't help directly, he advises, at least we should keep them in our hearts and pray for them. Then Shantideva continues with his dedication in the next couple of verses, which singles out hunger and thirst and wealth. "May a rain of food and drink descend," he says, "to clear away the pain of thirst and hunger, and during the eon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need, and may these be placed close beside them." In the Buddhist cosmology, there will be an eon of lack of food and drink in the world in the future, and this is what Shantideva is referring to in this verse 9. Perhaps the ancients foresaw the effects of our activities on this planet, including climate change, which, according to the scientists, is causing a worrying scarcity of fresh water for millions. In 2004, more than a billion people had to walk for 3 hours or more to fetch fresh water, and the world population is growing at a rate of 80 million a year. So unless we come up with some pretty radical solutions, the Buddhist forecast could be right. And then in verse 10, talking about becoming an inexhaustible treasure, Shantideva is not only talking about people's physical destitution, but spiritual poverty as well. Pema Chodron uses the example of an ancient yogi by the name of Naropa, out walking one day when he came across a sick, maggot-ridden dog lying in his way. In some disgust, Naropa made as if to step over it, but then a vision of his teacher Tilopa appeared to him, saying, "If you have aversion for sentient beings, how can you rid yourself of samsaric mind?" In effect, we should not shy away from any suffering, because we can use it to awaken our wisdom and compassion. And communication is so swift and wide-ranging today, we don't need to go out to purposely seek out maggot-infested hounds. it's very easy to find countless instances of intense suffering to use as our examples for our bodhisattva aspiration, such as on Amnesty International or Animal for Asia's websites, for instance. And these are just two of many. But we don't even have to go to activists' websites. The news can sometimes make for some piteous reading. Then Shantideva says, "Without any sense of loss, I shall give up my body and enjoyments, as well as all my virtues of the three times, for the sake of benefiting all." When dedicating ourselves and all we own to benefit of others, we have three possessions to give away: our body, our possessions, and all the positive potential that ripens into agreeable situations for us. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, however, lists four aspects that we must be aware of when thinking of giving away these most precious things to us. The four aspects are giving, protecting, purifying, and proliferating. Let's take, for instance, giving away our body. Now, a real bodhisattva has no qualms about giving away his or her body. A famous story about the Buddha in one of his previous lives is a nice illustration of this. The Buddha was a bodhisattva prince in that life who, while walking in the forest one day, came across a sick tigress with five cubs. The tigress was so weak that she couldn't get food for herself and so was starving to death. The prince realized that if the mother died, so in all probability would the cubs. And feeling immense compassion for the animals, he drew his sword and cut some of his flesh to give to the tigress. Then he killed himself so that she would have enough to eat. This is an example of the first of the four aspects, giving. When the time is right, then a bodhisattva should give his or her body like this, if necessary. However, before we get to that stage, we need our body to practice the Dharma. And also, if we give our body with a sense of regret or fear, it will not be a very positive action. So, before we are at that stage where we can give our body without any regret or fear, we should protect it. And that is what is meant by the second aspect, protecting. Then, while we have our body, we ought to use it to purify negativities and not allow it to be overcome by afflictive emotions, which will just hinder our progress on the path to enlightenment. Thus, the third aspect is purifying. Of course, if we don't purify our negativities or make some effort to curb the afflictive emotions, it will be extremely difficult for us to become a bodhisattva or arhat, because we will just continue to become more and more enmeshed in cyclic existence. Then the fourth aspect, proliferating, refers to doing as many virtuous actions as we can with a human body, so that we can be reborn with such a body, or a rebirth in which we can continue with our practice of the Dharma again and again in the future. The same logic applies to dedicating our possessions and positive potential. For both, we should give them away to benefit others if we are ready and able. We should protect them otherwise, while using them to free ourselves from afflictive emotions and purify negativities. And then lastly, we also use them to increase our virtuous actions so as to attain useful rebirths in the future. Now you might ask how we give away our positive potential. His Holiness says that first we remember our virtuous actions and rejoice in them. And then we imagine giving the positive potential to others so that they may experience the happiness of it. Giving up our body, possessions, and virtue, says Pema Chodron, is the closest we can get to everything that we regard as me and mine. This me and mine is like the cage that keeps us bound up in the self-absorption that is always whining, "I want this, and I need that," like a needy, cantankerous child. In contrast, a person on the path to enlightenment is always consciously shedding, opening up, and surrendering. Pema Chodron said it's like removing layer after layer of clothing until we are completely naked with nothing to hide. But we can't just pretend, she says, making a big display of disrobing and then putting everything back on when no one is looking. We have to be genuine. She talks about the Tibetan word shempa, which we translate as attachment, but which one Tibetan master described as the charge behind emotions, the charge behind I like and I don't like, the charge behind self-importance. Pema Chodron says it's the feeling of getting hooked, a non-verbal tightening or shutting down. Suppose you're talking to someone and suddenly you see her jaw clench, she stiffens, or her eyes glaze over. What you're seeing is shenpa, the outer manifestation of an inner tug, the subtlest form of aversion or attraction. We can see this in each other. More importantly, we can feel this charge in ourselves, she says. Well, think about your favorite possession. Now imagine that it is stolen or broken. You will never get another like it. The charge that comes with the stab of fear, the longing, is shempa. It's as though we're not consciously thinking about it. We put our trust in the possession to bring us security and happiness. It's that sticky feeling, says Pema Chodron, that arises when we want things to go our way. When I travel any long distance, I usually take my MacBook computer with me, and often at the back of my mind is the niggle that it will be stolen, that I will be left without it. I feel like hiding it somehow so that people will not notice it. That is driven by shenpa. And what about our body? We may feel insecure about its health or its appearance, or we worry about its discomfort. That again is fueled by shenpa. Pema Chodron puts it into perspective like this. This body is a precious vessel, she says, our ship for reaching enlightenment. But if we spend all of our time painting the decks, we will never leave port and this brief opportunity will be lost. Moreover, our body, like everything else, is impermanent and prone to death and decay. Perhaps it's time to see it for what it is and stop strengthening shenpa. Now, if it's difficult to give up our body, it's even more of a challenge to give up our merit or positive potential, the basis for all our enjoyment, comfort, and status. Imagine giving up the very cause for all that makes you comfortable, healthy, and happy, so that others can instead have comfort, health, and happiness. Will you be able to do that? Now, even though I'm a monk and supposed to have given up everything for the homeless life, I find this thought difficult to contemplate. I might talk about living under a tree with just my robes and a bowl, training my mind in contentment no matter what the weather, but a single night out in a cold New Zealand night may well be too much. Letting go of our merit means letting go on the most profound and difficult level, according to Pema Chodron. We would have to give up all thoughts, conscious and unconscious, of security. We have to give up any illusion of certainty. The idea might be terrifying, but that is ultimately what will free us from the attachment, shenpa, that keeps us bound to samsara. His Holiness, in his commentary to this text, agrees with this analysis of shenpa. The evil of attachment, according to the Buddhists, he says, is not so much concerned with external objects as to that which generates the afflictive emotions. The charge Pema Chodron talks about that is closely associated with our sense of ourselves. For instance, His Holiness says, when we say, that is so beautiful, the beauty is in relation to the I, to me, so we are always relating the object of attachment to the self. As long as we have a strong sense of I, naturally the attachment associated with me will be intense. Thus, not only do outside objects foster attachment within us, but the sense of I, His Holiness says, makes a large contribution to attachment and aversion alike. The stronger the sense of I, the stronger our attachment to external objects. If we look at our everyday life, we can easily see this. Go to some shop, and you might see an object you like. Before you buy it, the sense of attachment is not as strong as when you've already bought it. The sense of longing and the attachment come about through the grasping at possessor and possessed. From a Buddhist perspective, then, the afflictive emotions, especially of attachment, are caused by this sense of I. To reduce attachment, we must then analyze whether this sense of I is valid or invalid. Now, this becomes a bit technical, but if there is a self that is not self-sufficient and independent, what is its mode of existence? If there is a concrete self, one that does not exist independence on anything else, His Holiness asks, how do you make a distinction between an old man and a young man, between male and female, and so on? These distinctions are made on the body, on the aggregates. Whatever appears to our mind does so as if it were independent and existed intrinsically. If it actually did, then what is the need for anyone to say that it depends on other factors? The object in question has no need of other factors for its existence. It does not need the help of anyone imputing that it depends on other factors. However, our experience is that everything depends on other factors. And when we try to find an object's intrinsic self under critical analysis, we cannot. Understanding this on a subtle level would lead us to understanding the nature of reality, which tells us that there is no objective independent reality. Everything conceived in the mind is lacking inherent independent existence and comes about through mere designation. Emptiness, meaning that everything is empty of inherent independent existence, is so important because when afflictive emotions arise, they are inextricably connected to the self-grasping mind based on ignorance that sees things existing independently. When something appears in this way to our mind and we react to it, we should analyze to see if that is really the way it exists. Analyzing well, we see that when something appears truly beautiful or ugly, respectively, attachment and aversion arise. So the afflictive emotions are either directly or indirectly related to the self-grasping mind. And unless you understand that the self-grasping mind is distorted in the way it apprehends, unless you understand emptiness, you cannot free yourself from afflictions. It is through understanding the emptiness of inherent existence that we understand that the self-grasping mind is ignorant and not a valid mind. And so, all afflictive emotions that arise through this mistaken mind are undermined, and we don't then intensify the self-grasping mind. This wisdom is thus the only thing that is in direct opposition to the ignorance that views things as inherently existent. As this is so, His Holiness says, that the wisdom realizing emptiness is also the remedy to all other afflictive emotions. The ultimate interpretation of selflessness is emptiness, or the lack of inherent existence of intrinsic reality, and it is this that helps free us from both the afflictive and cognitive obscurations. For this wisdom to be most effective in eliminating the cognitive obscurations, it must be accompanied by bodhicitta. It is this giving up our instinctive grasping at the self and its lust for possessions and so on that brings us freedom. And that is why Shantideva goes on to say, by giving up all, sorrow is transcended, and my mind will realize the sorrowless state. It is best that I now give everything to all beings, in the same way as I shall at death. The sorrowless state, of course, is nirvana or liberation, and to achieve it, we have to give up everything, even our grasping at our own dear self and any longing for the security that brings. As Pema Chodron says, no holding back for a rainy day. The hardest message for any of us to hear. And then Shantideva says something that we might find very difficult to bear. Having given this body up for the pleasure of all living beings, by killing, abusing, and beating it, may they always do as they please. Although they may play with my body and make it a source of jest and blame, because I have given it up to them, what is the use of holding it dear? When I first read these verses, I was appalled, says Pema Chodron. I didn't want to consider going this far, nor did I think it wise to do so. From a Western perspective, this advice seems to feed right into the self-loathing so prevalent in our culture. but knowing that Shantideva's intention is always to support and encourage us, I looked past my initial aversion and discovered the wisdom of his words. This, I realized, was the approach of the civil rights workers. In order to benefit not only African Americans, but also their oppressors, they were willing to put their bodies and feelings on the line. For the greater good, they entered into dangerous situations. Being the source of jest and blame was the very least of it. They knew they would be beaten, insulted, and perhaps killed. This is an example of the Bodhisattva wisdom and courage. Yet these were just ordinary people who had given birth to the Bodhi heart. These verses describe what most famous Bodhisattvas were willing to go through. People like Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, Aung San Suu Kyi, and Gandhi. It also describes the bravery of countless unsung heroes and heroines. That is how Pema Chodron describes her reaction to these verses, and her words remind me of the many Tibetan activists who have given their liberty and lives in the struggle against the human rights abuses of the Chinese communists. I cannot imagine setting myself on fire for anything, yet you would have heard of both ordained and lay Tibetans who have immolated themselves so that Tibetans may live with more freedom, comfort, and dignity. There must also have been an element of the Bodhi mind that encouraged the Myanmar monks to come out against the extreme actions of their military government in 2007. We must remember, though, that Shantideva's words about giving up the body for the pleasure of all living beings doesn't mean yielding it for some insignificant aim. We must be careful, because as we said before, this body is our vessel to carry us to enlightenment, and we have to consider carefully whether giving it up will fulfill our wish to gain enlightenment to best benefit all other beings or not. If the purpose is frivolous, or even if it is better to refuse so that a greater benefit is achieved, then we should not give up our body. But once given up, we must have no regrets. As Shantideva goes on to say, "Therefore I shall let them do anything to it that does not cause them any harm, and when anyone encounters me, may it never be meaningless for him." Those who cause us or others harm are actually hurting themselves more than they are harming their intended victims. Look at the effect on your mind of harm you have caused, and you will see that long after the actual event, some residue of shame or aggression lingers on. I can still remember an incident when I was in boarding school in which I and some other boys played a prank on one of our classmates that we knew would cause him intense embarrassment and anger. He has long gone out of my life and may or may not have forgotten, but the incident still haunts me, especially as he had previously showed me some friendliness. Now, doubt it will do so until I make some amends or come to terms with it. But like that, those who cause us harm are creating difficulties for themselves in the future. And if we can remember this at the time, maybe we can generate compassion for them rather than anger. This is one way of giving up our body for the welfare of others. As Pema Chodron says, if we take a long-range perspective like this, we sow the seed of happiness for everyone. And now, our time is up, and we must leave Shantideva there. Please take a moment to dedicate any positive potential from this program to gaining enlightenment for all sentient beings. Thank you for joining me today, and I hope we can come together again next week. Goodbye.